Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm joined by Dr. Ali Al-Yami, who's the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. A native of Saudi Arabia, has lived in the United States for many years, where he has advocated for political reforms in Saudi Arabia and provided testimony regarding human rights in Saudi Arabia before the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Al-Yami.
Thank you.
This shoe that could eventually drop, the Saudi Arabian shoe, of course, is the big one. Many are surprised by the extent of demonstrations in Syria, where they've had an entrenched dictatorship under emergency rule, just like they had in Egypt as well. And yet hundreds of thousands of people are taking to the streets, and they're not going away. Now, we haven't seen that in Saudi Arabia, but we did see in the last few days in the eastern region hundreds of Shiites demonstrating in the oil-producing areas in and around Qatif, and some of them were showing solidarity with the Shiites in nearby Bahrain. So what do you make of that?
Well, we haven't seen major demonstrations in Saudi Arabia because the Saudi government mobilized all of its layers of security apparatus on 11th of March when people were supposed to go out and demonstrate, and nobody was even able to move between mosques and the streets and that kind of thing. And there were threats. There were threats for people even to lose their citizenship if anybody demonstrates, and fine 30,000 riyals and go to jail for 5 years. This is if they decide to demonstrate. If you demonstrate, that's the penalty could be more severe. The Saudis are known for their brutality. We haven't seen major demonstrations in Saudi Arabia. That doesn't mean people are not preparing for it. People have more grievances. The Saudi people have more grievances than anybody in the Arab world because of religious, social, political, educational, economic oppression. So the Saudi people are mobilizing. They may not be ready at this minute. The Saudi security is very, very brutal and very severe. The Saudi people have never had chance to organize before, so this is new to them. And, of course, there is no civil society in Saudi Arabia for people to meet each other, and there is all this gender segregation and religious discrimination and all of this. But you mentioned that Syria, which is absolute dictatorship like Saudi Arabia, the Syrian people are demonstrated, hundreds of thousands. Nobody should be surprised when the Saudis do the same, whether it's going to happen next month or next week or within 2 months or 3 months. Interestingly enough, here in Washington, D.C., even the most people who defend the Saudi system and deny that anything like what happened in the Arab world will happen in Saudi Arabia, they don't do that anymore. But they cannot predict when trouble will happen. And if the trouble happens in Saudi Arabia, it could make all of the things that have been happening in Egypt and Syria and Yemen and Indonesia look like a picnic because of the system, because of the country's importance, because of the oil, because of Iran. It could get very nasty.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Ali Al-Yami, founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. And a lot of the Saudi dissidents in London, of course, it's been difficult to get in touch with them. Demonstrations now are being photographed by Saudi intelligence. Apparently young Saudis who've demonstrated in favor of the Arab Spring have had their citizenship threatened, if not cut off, and their scholarships taken away. Now, the ailing 87-year-old King Abdullah has announced financial handouts worth an astonishing $130 billion. Do you think they can buy their way out of this?
Not at all. I think the Saudi people were extremely disappointed because they have seen King Abdullah as a reformer. So when he gave that 4-minute speech in March, and the first thing he said, I mean, Saudi Arabia is going backward. Now the people now realize that King Abdullah is not a reformer at all. But the first thing he said was to thank to thank the religious establishment for issuing fatwa against demonstration against the government as an Islamic. That's the first thing he said. He thanked the religious establishment, and he also issued a threat to the media or anybody who would, for example, denigrate the religious establishment. That means he put them above all laws, and the media couldn't even talk about them. He promised to hire 60,000 people extra security men to help Prince Nayef, control any possibility of any movement, including demonstration against the system. So those are the first things that he said.
The system, by the way, we know is that it's been in place, and that's how the House of Saud stays in power. They use the Wahhabi clerical establishment with its austere Hanbali interpretation of Islam as a way to keep the people oppressed. But the clerical council, the religious police, are not the decision makers in Saudi Arabia. They're just employees of the government. Under the divine seal of the king and his coterie of emirs, one of whom, by the way, just this week, Prince Turki Al Faisal, the former head of intelligence, he called for reforms at a Jeddah Economic Forum 2 weeks ago, appealing for elections to the Shura, the appointed parliament. So even within the House of Saud, there are some people who see the writing on the wall, apparently.
Absolutely. You know, he's one of them, but more than him, there are some of the young Saudi royal family, member of the Saudi royal family, but the older ones too, including Prince Talal, who is her brother of King Abdullah, and he's in his 70s, and he has been calling for a constitutional monarchy since 1962. King Abdullah's daughter, actually, two of his daughters, Adila and Sita, are also very active in women's rights and civil society rights as much as they could. So there are some members in the royal family. There is no question about that. But the thing is, for them, for the royal family, the ones who are seeing the writing on the wall, and they should be seeing the writing on the wall because it is big, and if you cannot see it, then there is a problem here. But what the Saudi ruling family, regardless whether they are liberals or conservatives, they have only one item in their agenda, and that is to maintain the royal family in power. Now, some of these people, some of the ones that are calling for some kind of cosmetic or some reforms, understand and realize without that, their fate will be similar to Mubarak and other people, because the people, for the first time in Arab history, the Arab people, especially the young generation, which is about 60-70% of all Arabs, are under the age of 25, and they are the Facebook people. This generation decides to take charge of its life, and that's why you see the situation in Libya and Egypt and Tunisia and Yemen and Bahrain and Algeria. This is a new generation of people who are not afraid anymore, like their parents and grandparents. They compare their life and their lot with their counterpart all over the world. They see the gaps between the haves and the have-nots. Saudi Arabia receives about $300-400 billion a year from the oil. And all of that money goes to one family, and that's the House of Saud, and the rest of the country only get their crumbs. So things are changing, and they will change in Saudi Arabia. The biggest concern we should have, or the question we should be asking, is what is the United States going to do when trouble happens in Saudi Arabia? Are we going to support the royal family to slaughter people like we are supporting the Bahrainis to slaughter their people now with the help of the Saudis? Or are we going to develop a new strategy, a new policy, where we support the inevitable? And that is when there is an uprising in Saudi Arabia, we are there to support them. I think the president did a good job in supporting the Egyptian people, a little late, but he did support the Egyptian people and the Tunisian people and the Libyan people, and he called for those heads of states to step down. Are we going to do that to the Saudis? Or are we going to continue to support them, which is to our detriment if we do that?
Well, obviously the Saudi regime is using the threat of Iran as a way to hold on to power. There's nothing new about that, but that's not to say that Iran is trying to undermine Saudi influence in the Islamic world, and they're challenging the Saudis' legitimacy as the custodians of Islam, as you well know. And the Israelis are not being helpful. Back in 2002, King Abdullah tried to rally the Arab world to recognize Israel in exchange for accepting the 67 borders. That got nowhere. His motive for doing that was the belief that if you dealt with this Palestinian issue honestly, it would deny Iran a key pillar of its regional strategy to win over Islam, which is clearly what they're trying to do. And then, of course, more recently, President Obama declined a personal appeal from King Abdullah to withhold the U.S. veto at the United Nations from the resolution condemning continued Israeli settlements in Jerusalem and the West Bank. So we're not being helpful, and the Israeli right, of course, is being completely boneheaded.
Look, first of all, there are two major points. You mentioned too many points, but two important points here that needs clarification, maybe three. One, there is absolutely no difference between the Saudi and the Iranian policy in terms of their attitude toward America. The Saudi royal family and the Iranian mullahs in Tehran, they have exactly the same objective. Get America out of Arab and Muslim countries, because they see America as their enemy number one, because America is the only country that can promote and support democratic changes on Arab and Muslim countries. So both of them want America out of the region. That's the common objective between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
In 2 minutes, wrap it up here if you can, the three other points.
Okay, that's one thing. So the Iranian and the Saudis are working for the same objective, and their difference is actually is not as severe as people would say. In terms of King Abdullah trying to rally Arabs to support the Arab peace process that was initiated in Lebanon, I believe, in 2002 or 2003, Abdullah was asking for things that nobody can accept. The Palestinians actually thought Abdullah demands for the Israeli total withdrawal from everything in the East Jerusalem, and the return of the refugees. The Palestinians said this is too much and nobody can accept it, and it is actually designed to create more stalemate. So Abdullah's interest in the Arab-Israeli conflict, he only has one interest, and that is to retain East Jerusalem, the Muslim section of that city, to the Saudis, so Abdullah can make it a Wahhabi city, which if I were an Israeli, I would be very, very concerned about my fate if that happens. So the Saudis and the Iranians are not exactly the enemies they pretend or they try to convince you and me and the rest of the world. They have better relationship now. Iran has better relationship with Arabs today than it has ever had in the history of the Iranian and Arab relationships. I mean, the Iranians are a member of the Organization for Islamic Conference. They are very member of OPEC, they are member of all Arab Muslim organizations, and their membership sit in Riyadh and Mecca and Jeddah and Medina and everywhere else. So I wouldn't buy the argument that the Saudis are threatened by Iran. Of course, Iran wants to extend its authority over Muslims and so are the Saudis. And that is a competition, political competition between two absolute regimes, whose actually main objective is to destroy democracies all over the world.
Let's end it here because we've run out of time. And I thank you for joining us here in Los Angeles, Dr. Ali Al-Yami.
You're welcome.
Again, Dr. Al-Yami is the founder and director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. Well, let's do a wrap-up on today's program. What did we learn? Well, we started out with Cliff Schechter, a veteran campaign political strategist and a former pollster for President Bill Clinton's re-election in 1996. I asked him essentially, when are the Democrats going to step up? The Republicans are moving the goalposts so far to the right. This Ryan budget is social Darwinism at its worst. They're going to even have more tax cuts for the rich. How come the Tea Party's running the show? Where's the Democratic or left-wing equivalent of the Tea Party? And he answered most of those challenges. He felt ultimately that it wasn't mutually exclusive to, one, have President Obama's back and not desert him, but on the other hand, to hold his feet to the fire and for progressives to push hard. Now, that is great in theory, but I don't see it happening in reality, and I still am still mystified by the apparent apathy on the left, given how crazy these Republicans are and what they're doing, and they're turning this country back to the Gilded Age. Then we had a very interesting conversation with Colonel Andrew Bacevich, a retired U.S. Army colonel who lost his son in Iraq. His latest book is Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. He's a critic of the U.S. intervention in Libya, says that we always resort to the sword. We don't have anything else in our toolbox, and it's getting us nowhere, and that Obama is following essentially Bush's dysfunctional war on terror. And he also tied the conversation into the budget and how the budget is ultimately a moral document, and that the U.S. cannot spend more money on defense than it spent in real dollars during the Korean War and the Vietnam War. And we're spending more than anybody else in the world, or everybody else in the world combined for that matter, and look where it's getting us. And we have to change both our foreign policy and our domestic defense policy. And then we had an interesting discussion with a Saudi dissident, Dr. Ali Al-Yami, director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia, to really find out whether that big shoe is going to drop. Syria's caught people by surprise. Saudi seems to be locked up by the religious police and by this reactionary royal family. But the more he talked, the more you realize that there's a lot going on beneath the surface in Saudi Arabia, and that since we've been caught by surprise so often, we may well be caught by surprise again. And even within the Saudi royal family, some of the former head of intelligence, Prince Turki, is now calling for political reform. And he believed ultimately that the so-called clash between Saudi Arabia and Iran is a total phony, that they, in fact, the Saudi regime and the Iranian regime have more in common in being against the Americans and wanting them out of the Gulf than they do have in terms of their adversarial or their alleged adversarial standoff in the Gulf. I would like to thank producers Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. If you heard something you like, something that you don't like, any suggestions or tips, let us know. We read every email. You can also check out my blog at ianmasters.com. Click on blog. Bye for now.